as we walk through the Pentateuch, that you would help us to recognize a few things, recognize our own sinfulness, recognize your faithfulness, and recognize your desire to save for yourself a people, to glorify yourself because of that and through that. Lord, thank you for just the opportunity we get to see you at work. We ask this in your name, amen. All right, Exodus 32 is where we are. We are in this. We're walking through the golden calf situation. I do think that, and this was brought to my attention last week. All of this is set, and I think it's important to understand why things are written in the Bible the way they're written. All of this is set against the omniscience of God. Okay, we need to understand that none of this caught God by surprise. None of this was an, now what am I going to do? But this was all in God's preordained, pre-decreed plan this was going to happen. But I think as we read this, we don't need to read it from God's point of view. Because we could read everything in that sense, and everything could go that way, and it almost would lead to a sort of fatalism, if you will. Well, God did it, so what can I do about it? It almost could result in that kind of response. But I think the reason that this is written the way it's written is so that we can recognize that man is responsible for the sin that man commits. And that sin that man commits does in fact and indeed anger God when it is committed. The fact is that even because sin is here and God is sovereign doesn't mean God somehow takes sin less seriously than he does. And when sin happens, God takes it seriously, and God is angry about that sin. I think that's something that we must read this with that intent. It's also important to recognize why Moses is writing this. Moses is not necessarily writing this just to give an accurate historical account of the beginning of things. That's not why he's writing. He's writing this for a specific purpose, and the specific purpose is to equip the Jews, to equip Israel to go in and take the land that they are told they are going to go possess. That's why he's walked through. If you're reading through with us the chronological read through the Bible this year, and especially as you've read through Genesis, you see Moses setting the stage for the Canaanites and how bad the Canaanites were. And I think what he's doing as he lays out the evil of the Canaanites is he's letting the folks know, letting this generation know, we are rightful owners of this land. I mean, put yourself in the Israelites' place. They've been in Egypt for 400 years. And now they're wandering in the wilderness. And as they get to Deuteronomy, they've been wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. They have never known this place they're going to go take as home. And the question could be said, well, why do we have legitimate right to that place? And Moses sets up for them why they have that legitimate right. This is written so that they will be equipped to do what it is God has called them to. That's what it's all about. It's really so that they will know the God who they serve, know him, and know him well. I think that's what it's about. And so as they know him well, then the desire is that they would respond to him the correct way. And the correct way to respond to him is not by box-checking obedience. That's not what he wanted. The correct way to respond to him was by loving him, by fearing, a theme we hear, especially as you get to Deuteronomy, that love to fear and to obey. That's what he's trying to get them to do. And I think the reason the golden calf narrative is here is to let this generation fear him as this generation is going to go into a land where idolatry is rampant, where it is all over the place. And they need to know that God takes sin seriously. And one of the things that God is, and he'll state this later on in the Old Testament, that he is a jealous God and he will share his glory with no other. He will not share his glory, and he takes the stealing of his glory very seriously. And so I believe that's what he's setting up. He's also setting this up as for that people, that generation that's to come, to recognize that it's not because they're something special that God has chosen them. In Deuteronomy 7, God is actually going to lay out five reasons why they're not special. Five reasons that, and they're all wilderness kinds of things. They're all things that have happened to them in the wilderness that God says, because of these five things, it's not about you that I chose you. It's about me that I chose you. And one of those things that he mentions is the golden calf. The golden calf. So it's also shown, I think, here to show that these people were really undeserving of God's grace and really showing the unmerited sense of grace, why grace is unmerited favor. So, and if you, I actually preached an entire message on that a couple years ago. I think it was a couple years ago. If you want to search the website, Deuteronomy 7, I preached that. So I'm not going to preach that again. So that's why it's here. And we're going to have several instances as we go forward from here on. We're going to have several instances where the people fail and God gets angry and God sends a plague. Did God know that? Absolutely, he did. Absolutely, he knew it was going to happen. It didn't catch him off guard, didn't catch him by surprise. He was omniscient and sovereign in all of it and providential in all of it. But that doesn't negate the responsibility of the person who commits the sin. I just think that's really important. So that's where we are right now. We're at the guilt. The sin has been committed. The people have worshipped this golden calf. They have violated commandment number one, which they were not supposed to do. They violated commandment number one. God has recognized that's going to happen, or through Moses, God recognized that. He already knew it was going to happen, absolutely. But through Moses, God says, the people have so quickly gone astray. They've quickly done this. And so he says, leave me alone. Leave me alone so I can destroy this people. Moses does not leave him alone. Moses takes seriously his responsibility as the intercessor for the people and immediately intercedes for them on their behalf, saying, no, you can't do that, and brings the reputation of God up and his faithfulness to his word up, and says, you, this is wrong. You can't just start over with me. And I think that's one of those times where Moses demonstrates humility. Moses demonstrates humility here because, if I'm in that place and I've already led this people, and I've led this people, and every time something goes wrong, they're blaming me for it, I might say, you know what, yeah, I might go ahead and say, okay, that's fine, let me get out of the way, you take them out, God. Moses does not do that. Moses intercedes for this stubborn and stiff-necked people, and he gets in the way, he gets between them and God, and intercedes on their behalf and says, God, you can't destroy them. And so God relents because of, apparently, because of Moses' intercession, God relents from the calamity he would bring upon them. Another lesson there. We are called to go before God in prayer for each other, to intercede for one another on each other's behalf. And we don't know. We don't know. Prayer is one thing, I got to tell you, prayer is one thing that I do not understand. I don't get prayer. With regard to how it moves God, I don't get that. But I promise you, prayer does move God in some sense. It does. Jesus said that when he told the parable of the unjust judge and the persistent widow. If you recall, in the New Testament, Jesus is telling a story about a judge who has heard a widow's complaint, and he says, no, I will not. And this widow persists over and over and over again, and as she persists, the judge says, okay, all right, I give. Uncle, I'll grant your request. And Jesus uses that as an example of that we should come before God over and over and over again with these requests, with these things, with the desires that we have, and it, somehow it moves God to a seeming change in response. Now understand that doesn't, God's character is not changing. God's righteousness is not changing. God's justice is not changing. God's nature is not changing. None of that is changing. But somehow it appears, and there's other examples in the scripture of this, that God, through the intercession or through repentance or through somehow, God does appear to relent. I wish I could tell you I know exactly the three steps how that works, but it does work. Yeah, go ahead, Miley. Mylene's question would be: would it be fair to say or right to say that God was willing to and was, you know, would destroy them, but He knew that Moses was going to intercede, and so He didn't? I think that's a good way for us as humans to try to get our head wrapped around it. But I think that's a good way for humans for us to try to get our head wrapped around it. I don't know that really answers the question completely. At least it leaves me wanting something. It leaves me wanting this. It almost seems, if we go there, that when God said, "Get out of the way, I'm going to destroy this people," He was being, in some sense, disingenuous. And I don't think He was at all. I don't think He was at all. I think that if Moses had gotten out of the way, God would have destroyed the people. I absolutely believe that. So it was more than just a willingness to. More than just a willingness to. And again, this is when you get into... this is when you get into trouble with finite minds trying to grasp an infinite God. It's really hard for us to do that. So let's just quit trying. No, absolutely not. We should keep trying. We should keep trying. God has revealed Himself so that we can know Him, and that should drive us. What typically two responses when something like this is big about God? Either we say, "Well, it's too big, I can't do it," or it drives us to know Him better. It drives us to know Him more. What it does for me is drive me to know Him better and drive me to try to figure it out, not to say, "I'm quitting." That's the approach a lot of people take to the book of Revelation. It's just too hard. It's just too hard. Well, you know, we walked through it for 4 years in this Sunday school class, and I think we found out it really isn't too hard. It's communication. It's God communicating to us. And I think there should be a drive and desire for us to know Him and not just say, "I can't get it, so I'm giving up." No, it makes me want to know better. Chris, you had a... Moses is in the lineage of Isaac and Jacob. Yeah, Moses is a descendant of Jacob. Moses is, because he's a descendant of Levi. Levi is Jacob's third son. So we know that Moses is in that line. So it would have still been a Jew, but it wouldn't have been the 12 tribes of Israel, which is who God had, you know, promised to work through. So you know, you could almost say, well, Moses, you could have been still been a Jew, right? It still would have worked, but it wouldn't have been what God had intended. So anyhow, that's pre-stuff. That's not even that you get that for free. But that's just trying to get in our head and work through God's omniscience alongside of his the timeline of revelation. Because God has always known everything. The fact is we haven't. We haven't. And so we need to see how it plays out. And I think that's why it's here. So going beyond that now, let's dig into where we are. We are at the point where Moses has interceded for the people, and God has relented. And then Moses, remember, Moses has gone down, and it's a good thing that they're not on the same page at the same time, because Moses goes down and he's like, "Ah, I can't believe you." And he gets angry, he throws the tablets down, he does this thing where he says, "What have you done?" Aaron makes his flimsy excuse about, "Well, I threw gold in the fire and out came this calf. I don't know, it just happened." And so Moses has called the Levites, or calls anyone who is on the Lord's side to come to his place with him. The Levites respond, and then the Levites exact some repayment on the people. 3,000 men die that day. And that sets the Levites apart, because the Levites stood against their own family, and God says, "Bless them." Again, another indication of why God blessed the Levites a little bit. That gets us to verse 30, where we have Moses' intercession. The next day, Moses said to the people, "Lord, perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." So Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold, but now if you will forgive their sin, if you will, forgive their sin. But if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written." So that's Moses' intercession again is, hey, okay, God, they have sinned a great sin. They're guilty. There's no question about guilt. There's no question that the sin they sinned isn't a despicable sin. They have knowingly violated commandment number one, and they've done it quickly. They have sinned a great sin. I love how Moses described it. He doesn't blow it off as not significant. He says this, they have sinned a great sin. And so now Moses, on his own, is going to go see if he can make atonement for them. How is he going to do that? How is Moses going to seek to make atonement for them? Moses is going to offer himself in their place. Moses is going to actually put himself in the place and say, if you will, if you can, if you would, forgive their sin. But if you can't forgive their sin, then take me instead. Then take me instead. He asks to be blotted out of that book. And I don't think that Moses is making a, I can't think of the word, silly request. He's serious about this request. When he makes this offer, when he offers himself in their place, I think he's totally serious in making that offer. He is saying, do not blot them out, do not take them out of the way, but blot me out instead. Blot me out instead. It's an example of someone being willing to give his life for others. Not only give his physical life, but when Moses is being asked to be blot out of the book, I think what Moses is asking is, put their sin on me. Put their sin on me. I will take their sin on me so that they can be righteous. It's interesting that if you read, look at the parallels between Jesus and Moses. You look at the deliverance of the people of God's people from bondage to rest. You look at that. You look at Jesus' deliverance of God's people from bondage to rest. Moses offers himself in the place of the people. Jesus offers himself in the place of the people. But to Moses, God says no. To Jesus, God says yes. You see, if God had said, okay, I'll do that, it would have accomplished nothing. There would have been nothing accomplished because Moses, being a sinful man, cannot take the place of sinful men. Couldn't do it. I think there's a huge lesson there about who can stand in for someone else, who can rescue, really. And it couldn't be just Moses. It had to be somebody else. It had to be Jesus who was going to do that. And I think that Moses understood this, and in his response, he is asking for the spiritual consequences of this sin to become on him. He doesn't say, just kill me, God. He doesn't say that. He says, if you will not forgive their sin, then blot me out of your book. That's a very specific request. He is saying, put the eternal consequence of their sin on me and forgive them. That's what he's asking to have done. What is the book? What is the book that he's asking? I think it's the book of life that's recorded in Revelation. I think it's that book of life. And he's asking God to blot him out of that book of life. Well, you know, the problem is, if God would have blotted Moses out of that book of life, Hebrews tells us this whole generation had already been blotted out. And it would have accomplished nothing. I think it's important to recognize what Moses says he's going to go do for them. Moses doesn't say he's going to ask God to forgive. Moses says, perhaps I can go make atonement for you. See, Moses says, perhaps I can go and I can cover your sin. I can cover your sin. That's what atonement means. It's a covering. And Moses has already understood that for sin to be covered, there must be bloodshed. There must be bloodshed. So I think what Moses is doing, and I think the text gives us that indication really clearly, is Moses is going up and asking God to take him as a sacrifice in the place of the people. Well, it would have accomplished nothing. It would have accomplished nothing because the people he would have given himself for were already blotted out of the book. As you get to Hebrews, and if you want to get into Hebrews, come on Thursday morning, 6:30. If you're a guy, come on Thursday morning, 6:30. We're working our way through Hebrews really slowly. We've been in chapter 8, verse 1 for now like 5 weeks. It's an important verse. So we've been there, and then people ask questions. But in Hebrews, the author of Hebrews is walking through Moses and this generation in the wilderness, and he says that no one in that generation entered into rest. And he makes it very clear that he's not talking about the promised land. He makes it very clear that he's talking about that eternal rest that God had promised to his people. And so that would have accomplished, Moses giving himself in that place would have accomplished nothing. Would have accomplished nothing. And so God says, no. God says this in verse 33. This is God's response. But whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. So Moses, you as a man can't take the place of other men. You can't. Here's the deal. Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. So who does that include? It includes every person who's ever been born except for Jesus himself. That's a pretty bold statement. Yeah, but I'm not the one making it. I'm not the one making it. It's Paul who makes it in Romans chapter 5. For as by one man sin entered the world, and by sin death, so death passed upon most men. No. So death passed upon all men. For all have sinned. It fits right there. Whose sin? The one who has sinned, I will blot out. So God says to Moses, I think he's saying this already, bad news, Moses. Except for the work of grace, you're already blotted out. You're already blotted out. But there's a work of grace that takes place, and I believe Moses is not blotted out. I believe we'll see Moses. I really do think we're going to see Moses. And we can maybe ask him some questions. We'll get some clarification. I talked a little bit with Barb about that this morning. But, you know, the fact is, I don't think we'll want clarification when we get there. I don't think we'll want to see Moses. I really don't. I think our focus, our gaze will be lasered on the one who gave himself for us, not the one who tried, but the one who successfully gave himself for us at a cross and provided not just atonement, not just a covering for sin, but a purifying sacrifice. A satisfying sacrifice. That's a big difference. Moses offered atonement. Jesus offers purification. There's a big difference. But anyway, God says no. God says no. You go down. You lead the people. You do what I've told you to. My angel will go before you. Nevertheless, on the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them. I will hold their sin against them. You can't fix that, Moses. And then the Lord sends a plague. So his response is not only to tell Moses no, but he also sends a plague. I wish I could tell you what the plague is. I have no idea. But it's not the 3,000 who die when the Levites kill them. It's not the plague. There's a second plague that comes on the people that is not defined for us. It's not made clear, it's not spelled out what the plague is, but the God does send a plague on them because of their sin. And because of the calf, they made the calf the one, because of the calf, the one that Aaron made. It's total speculation and would be just a guess. So that is the golden calf narrative. A lot of lessons there. I think a lot of lessons there, a lot of truth that's really important. And then we get to verse 33, chapter 33, where things are going to now change. We've gotten through the golden calf. We've gotten the law given the first time. Did anybody have questions or comments? I'm really hoping I can finish a chapter today. That would be so cool to finish a chapter and move forward. All right, we're finished a chapter. Woohoo! Ding, 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 ding. Winna! Moving forward, chapter 33. And really, we're getting ready to leave Sinai. As we hit chapter 33, we are preparing now to leave Sinai. They've been there for a while. They've been there for at least 40 days, right? Because they got there. Moses goes up on the mountain. He's up there 40 days. He comes down. So they've been there at least 40 days. And now God says, it's time to get ready to go. Time to get ready to go. And there's a command to leave. But in this command to leave, there's also danger. There's danger. Listen to what God says. The Lord said to Moses, "Depart, go up from here, you and the people whom you have brought up out of the land of Egypt, to the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, to your offspring, I will give it. I will send an angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanites, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go up among you, lest I consume you on the way, for you are a stiff-necked people." You see what happened there? That's a scary thing. If you're a Jew, if you're an Israelite, if you're here, this is a very scary thing. Because God says, you go, I'll send an angel, but I'm not going. I'm not going. God had been with them crossing the Red Sea. He'd been with them as they made their way to Sinai. He'd been with them at Sinai. And now he says, get ready to go. I'm going to send an angel before you, but I'm not going. I'm not going. Because if I go, I will wipe you people out because you're stiff-necked. Again, second time that term has been used about this people now. First time was golden calf. Second time in Exodus 33, they're a stiff-necked people. Again, what that indicates is the stiff-necked indicates or is a reference to an ox that would refuse to be yoked and stiffen his neck so that the yoke, you couldn't get a yoke on him. And so when the farmer's trying to plow his field, the ox would not go the way that the farmer wanted him to go. He would not proceed in the path that the farmer was setting down for him to go. The ox would go his own way because it was a stiff-necked ox. That kind of an ox is worthless. That kind of an ox has no purpose at all, except it's eating a whole lot of food and accomplishing nothing. So God says to them, you're that kind of people. You are stiff-necked. You refuse to go in the way that I am trying to lead you. You're a stiff-necked people. And because of your refusal, there's a good likelihood that if I'm with you, I will wipe you out. I'll wipe you out. Look at the people. When the people heard this disastrous word, they mourned, and no one put on ornaments. You see, they got it. They got it. What had been the promise that God had made them in the land, in Egypt? He'd said, I will be your God. You will be my people. I will go before you. I will take you into the land of the Hittites, the Jebusites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Canaanites. I will go with you. I will go before you. I will drive them out. I will be your God, and you'll be my people. And now he's saying to them, I'll send an angel before you. He will drive out the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Canaanites. He will drive them out, but I'm not going. I'm not going. And the people, I love the word here, when they heard this disastrous word, they were devastated. This was disaster for them. It was terrible for them. And they understood why. And what did they do? Their response was, they didn't, in a sense, humiliated, and they were, in a sense, humbled, because they recognized how difficult and how disastrous this was. And so, because, verse 5, for the Lord had said to Moses, say to the people of Israel, you are stiff-necked people, for a single moment, I should go up among you, I would consume you. Now take off your ornaments that I may know what to do with you. So in Moses, when God goes to Moses and Moses says to people, it basically is this: humble yourselves. humble yourselves, and I'll see what is I'm going to do, because right now I'm not going with you. Right now I'm not going with you. Moses is going to go before God, and Moses is going to have is going to pray to him. He's going to beseech God. He's going to say, if you won't go with us, then I won't go. I won't go either. That's how Moses understands this. It is amazing to watch the interplay between Moses and God, how that works, and how Moses really, in a sense, goes to God and says, no, I want you to keep your word. Did God always intend to keep his word? Absolutely, yes. But was he disingenuous in saying, I'm not going? Absolutely, no. I think what it is, it's a lesson for us to learn that God does respond to intercession. He does respond to intercession. He responds to intercession that we do for each other, but more specifically, there's one interceding for us at his right hand that he's hearing all the time, and that is his son, Jesus Christ, who is interceding for us. So they, and it's interesting that they obey. Again, this is the second time. I told you one time all of Israel obeyed God. That was at Passover. This appears to be the second time. This appears to be the second time because they recognized this is serious. This is disastrous. This is awful. And while they were eager to throw God off at golden calf, now they recognize without God, this is disaster. We're hopeless without God. We need him. And so when he says, take off your rings, humble yourselves, they absolutely do that. They humble themselves. They stripped off their gold. They stripped off their ornaments. And they didn't wear them. They didn't wear them, it says, from Mount Horeb onward. They didn't wear them the rest of the trip. If that's what I understand that to say. They didn't wear them for the rest of the trip. They were, in some sense, humbled for the rest of the trip. Now, that would be great to say, and they got it, and they were wonderful, and life went good from there on. But this is just the beginning of the issues, the beginning of the stiff-neckedness that they have. Now we have verses 7 and through what? 7 through 11, we have this tent of meeting come up. That Moses, I'll just read the text and then we'll dig into it a little bit, because Moses is actually going to intercede for the people in this tent of meeting. So he's going to go there and intercede for the people. Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp, far off from the camp, and he called it the tent of meeting. And everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. Whenever Moses went out to the tent, all the people would rise up, and each would stand at his tent door and watch Moses until he'd gone into the tent. When Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent. And the Lord would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise up and worship, each at his tent door. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, as when a man speaks to his friend. When Moses turned again to the camp, his assistant Joshua, the son of Nun, apart from the tent. What is this tent? I say it's not the tabernacle. Okay? Here's the reasons it's not the tabernacle. And I'm sure had Ron been here, he might disagree with this, but he's not. He had his chance, he had his choice, he had the opportunity, he chose not to be here. So he doesn't get a word. I don't think this is the tabernacle. Why? First of all, who sets it up? Moses sets it up. Who sets the tabernacle up? All the Levites. The tabernacle is not something that can be set up by one man. The tabernacle is a huge piece of tent. It's a huge deal. Just, shh, shh. Act as if you heard Chris said nothing. Okay? So first of all, who sets it up? That's important. Moses sets it up, not all the Levites. Okay? So tabernacle set up by the Levites, this tent of meeting set up by Moses. Where is it set up? This tent is set up outside the camp. Where was the tabernacle set up? In the center of the camp. In the center of the camp is where the tabernacle was. It was right in the middle, and then all the tribes around aligned themselves in threes around that, with Levites interspersed in all the tribes. That's where the tabernacle was. The tabernacle center of the camp, the tent of meeting outside the camp. Okay? Significant. Who goes into the tent of meeting? Moses, don't stop. And Joshua. Moses and Joshua. Now, I don't think Joshua's necessarily in there when the meetings are taking place, but when Moses leaves, Joshua goes in. Is Joshua a Levite? No, he's not. So, would it be right for Joshua to go inside the tabernacle? He'd be killed instantly for usurping a place. No, he was not supposed to be in there. I don't know, actually, rethinking that, step back. He might not be killed instantly, but it wouldn't be kosher for him to be in there. I say he won't be killed because David goes in there, right? David goes in there and takes showbread. And David, I think, if you do the math, same tribe as Joshua. So anyway, that's something to consider. So who's in there? Who's in there? Moses and Joshua. Who's in the tabernacle? The priests and the high priests. Three. That's the third. Fourth, where's the presence of God at this tent? It's at the door. Right? It's at the door. Where's the presence of God in the tabernacle? Above the Holy of Holies on the mercy seat. Where's the mercy seat? Is it at the door? No, it's not at the door. Different place. So four reasons I believe this is a totally different place than the tabernacle. This tent of meeting is not the tabernacle. Fifth reason, the tabernacle is not built yet. Okay, so probably the best answer is the one I should have given last. First, I gave last, but it kills the suspense. If you just say it hadn't been built yet, it's okay. Okay, so yeah, it hasn't been built yet. In Exodus 33, the tabernacle is not yet built. I know that for a fact because it's the building of the tabernacle is chronicled from Exodus 35 on. That's when it's all built. So as of Exodus 33, it's not built. And Moses, 33. Okay, he goes in there and meets with God and tells him at that point, I ain't going. If you don't go, I don't go. You have to come with me. I can't lead these people without you. We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. But you got to come with me. Where is he doing that? He's doing that in the tent of meeting, which is already established and already set up outside the camp before the tabernacle is even built. So I don't think this can be the tabernacle. It's a separate tent of meeting. And those are the reasons why. I think that's a different thing. And so what was it for? It was for the time when Moses and God would meet as if it were face to face, as a man talks with his friend. And it's interesting, when the tabernacle was set up, when that tent of meeting was set up, the people would watch Moses start to walk outside. Okay, this is important. This is a big deal. Moses is going to go meet with God. So they would watch Moses walk up and meet with God. And it says that as soon as, I think that's what's going on. I think that's a great time that they were probably praying for God's protection. They were probably praying for God's direction. What Moses is in there meeting face to face, I wouldn't be surprised. They're praying for God to relent. They're asking God. They're worshiping him, and in a sense they're saying, don't kill us all, don't do this to us. I think they're recognizing the importance and the significance of these meeting times that Moses is going to have, especially this meeting time that Moses is going to have. So they would all come out. They would also there would also be a time when they would stand there at the entrance of their tent, and they would worship each at his tent door. And then again, Moses and God would speak to each other face to face as a man speaks to his friend. And when Moses would leave, he wouldn't leave the tent unattended. I don't know why. He wouldn't leave the tent unattended, but he would always make sure Joshua stayed. Joshua stayed at the tent. So that's what's going on there. 3 minutes. So that's the tent of meeting. We're going to go ahead and get into it. Now Moses prays in verse 12. Moses begins his prayer. And the first part of his prayer is for God to be with him, for God's presence. Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you've let me know whom you'll send with me. Yet you have said, I know you by name, and you've also found favor in my sight. Now, therefore, if I have found favor in your sight, please show me now your ways that I may know you in order to find favor in your sight. Consider, too, that this nation is your people." So Moses basically says, show me yourself. Let me know you. If I have found favor in your sight, if I really am your friend, and we're talking as friends face to face, if I really am your friend, show me yourself. Give me your direction. Let me walk in your ways. What is he asking? He's asking, go with us. Go with us. We need you to go with us. And God responds, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. Moses doesn't just say, oh, thank you. Moses says, but if you will not go with me, if your presence will not go with me, don't bring us up from here. Just let us stay here. If you're not going to go, just let us stay here. For how will it be known that I found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not in your going with us, so that we are distinct, I and your people, from every other people on the face of the earth? You see, it comes down to the special choice of God's nation, Israel, and what that displayed about God himself. That sets the stage for what we'll talk about next week. We're not done with that section. We're going to actually pry that section apart piece by piece, word by word. But we're still in that, in Moses going before God and saying, please go with us. We'll pick it up there next week, and we'll dig into that a little bit. Let me pray. Lord, thank you for your word, for your truth. Again, I thank you that recognizing no man could do this, but you did it specially through your Son, the eternal Son of God, God the Son, who gave himself in my place to forgive my sin. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for the joy we have in knowing you. We ask this all in your name. Amen. All right, thanks. You're dismissed.